How do we make change? How do we address unimaginable odds? How do we, mere individuals and a rather small religious community in the grand scheme of things, find a way to be present to the hurts of this world? Our forebears, the Universalists, were men and women who dared to think that God could not, under any circumstances, give a divine mandate to oppress others. They were believers who affirmed a God who was too good to make such demands, and a religion that was too important to corrupt with divine justification of human evil. Our forebears, the Unitarians, were among the folks like William Ellery Channing who bore the torch of the Christian message that not only could God never make a divine mandate to cause hurt, but that God always made a divine mandate to bring healing. Channing believed that social justice and religious living could not possibly be separated from each other because religion, he said, doesn't exist without its tangible consequences in the lives and the communities of the people who practice it. To Unitarian Universalists and to all people of faith, at our best, religion is a thing to be lived, not just thought about, an activity to be manifested not only in our hearts but in our streets. Faith is supposed to change something about this world. Religion is supposed to make a difference. Something is supposed to happen because of what we do here. And lately, faced with the immensity of suffering and the blinding divisions of our nation and our world, Unitarian Universalists and other people of faith have had to take a long, hard look at what really makes change, what really works. Not just what makes us feel better, but what works. Throughout our history, in our seminaries, in our congregations, and our boardrooms, we religious liberals have challenged ourselves not to shy away from asking the questions that cause the great debates. Because freedom of belief fires our convictions, we have also sought the elusive goal of staying in respectful relationship to one another, even when those debates bring about anything but consensus. You know, we need not think alike to love alike. We need not completely agree with one another in order to respect one another, and we need not have utter uniformity of opinion before we have action. Time and again, the guiding principles of our free faith have led our forebears, with or without consensus, to shake the foundations of their society. And if we start there, maybe, by looking at what has worked, by looking at what has changed everything in the past, perhaps we can work forward and reimagine what might yet give us the power to create change even now. Let me begin at the beginning, at least for Unitarian Universalists and change in America. Some of you may know that Massachusetts, and specifically Boston, is sort of understood as the epicenter, the birthplace of American Unitarianism. In the 1800s, Boston was home to William Ellery Channing, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and all these other luminaries that give Unitarianism its identity and its late greats. In many ways, 19th century Boston was our homeland, and that age was the place of our birth. I say that with love because it was a radical homeland. In 1780, just before American Unitarianism emerged as a movement, Boston became the first state to abolish slavery. By 1790, the census showed that there was not a single slave within its borders, but the debate was just beginning, and we were right in the middle of it. As later writers attest, the Boston aristocracy knew what side their bread was buttered on. As trade with the slave states tripled in the early part of the 19th century, congruent with the birth of Unitarianism, Boston merchants and businessmen stood to lose a lot of financial stability if the abolitionist movement succeeded. And Unitarians were generally not poor people. They knew that they would have to sacrifice if this change they espoused was going to happen. In 1835, the city of Boston decided to crush the abolitionists with a pro-slavery demonstration. Such was the sentiment of the times. Wealthy New England merchants found their livelihoods all tied up with the slave trade, and then, as it would be in the years to come, a culture found its whole ethical system dominated by the dollar. But there were some, among our forebears and among other religious traditions, who would not yield. From the most widely heard Unitarian pulpit in the country, William Ellery Channing said that, "We undoubtedly feel ourselves to be all of one race, and this as well. We trace ourselves up to one pain and feel the same blood flowing in our veins." Channing gave the cause language. He, more than anyone else, talked the talk of change in the abolitionist cause, and other generations proved themselves ready to walk the walk. Radical Unitarian preacher Theodore Parker was of a generation both braver and bolder and nurtured by the guys like William Ellery Channing. He was, without a doubt, the most prominent and controversial religious leader in Boston of his time, and he became the organizing force of a group he called the Vigilance Committee, which was committed to keeping any and all Southern slaves who could fight their way to Boston's free soil safely protected from the Southern searchers who made their way north. Claiming he would do absolutely anything in the cause of abolition, Theodore Parker loudly proclaimed that he answered to a higher law than that of the land. His law, he said, was the law of brotherhood, which has come down to us in the familiar language of the inherent worth and dignity of every person. There was a time when not a single pulpit in the city of Boston, even a Unitarian pulpit, was open to this man, because the ideas he espoused cut at the very underpinnings of the society that held up their financial well-being. But he made his own pulpit, he created his own church, and he preached on. The inherent worth and dignity of every person, slave or free or man or woman. Our Unitarian and Universalist forebears also include such illustrious servants of women's rights as Margaret Fuller, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and the first woman ever ordained in any denomination, Universalist minister, the Reverend Olympia Brown. At the beginning of the 1840s, Unitarian women were rallying with Parker around abolitionism and the right of blacks to gain suffrage, but suffrage for blacks was not enough. The women who stood before us in this line of liberal, religious change agency believed that we could use our free faith and the power it gave us to make a stand, to be counted in any assembly they chose. Charged by the writing and rhetoric of women like Fuller, it was at the First Unitarian Church in Rochester, New York, still one of our most vibrant congregations, that the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention was organized. There, the working goals of women's suffrage were defined, and Susan B. Anthony began her impassioned leadership that led her finally to cast her ballot in the 1872 presidential election. With another Unitarian, Clara Barton, Susan B. Anthony founded the second chapter of the American Red Cross. She worked against capital punishment. She joined labor and women's rights together, knowing that until all groups were free, none were. Susan B. Anthony's was a faith of action, because change came for her through the persistent dedication, not so much of prayer, but of hard work. When someone asked her, "Do you pray?" she responded by saying, "I pray every single second of my life, not on my knees, but with my work. My prayer is to lift women to equality with men. Work and worship are one with me. I cannot imagine a God of the universe made happy by my going down on my knees and calling him great." There have always been moments in the history of this nation when liberal religious people were called upon to live into our proclamations, proclamations of unity, of acceptance, of diversity. At least a few of those moments in our history are times we can be proud to say we rose to the challenge, times where we were a part of something that changed everything. One of those times was 1965, when Martin Luther King himself sent a telegram to the president of the newly formed Unitarian Universalist Association declaring simply that UUs were needed in Selma. Once the call came, no less than two-thirds of the ministers then serving our movement showed up, caravanning to walk beside Martin Luther King. One of those ministers, the Reverend James Reeb, then serving the All Souls Unitarian Church in D.C., gave up his life on that march. He was clubbed to death while marching for civil rights on March 11, 1965, and with his life, he proved that there are some things that should never be yielded to, some things that we must stand up for, some things that are too important to back away from. And this kind of vision, this kind of sacrifice, is not the territory of the religious right or of any particular political affiliation. We're capable of making the world more whole. History shows that we're capable of making the world different, of shaping it in spite of the most unimaginable odds. We've been doing it for hundreds of years in fits and starts, sometimes with more success than others, but always driven by the fundamental truth that change never happens unless we get off our knees and pray with our work in this world. But how? How to do that work now? Change has come through the course of history in so many ways. Channing preached it, but I am not so foolish as to think the words from any pulpit actually create the change in the world. It is our footsteps that carry those words forward. It is what we do with what we get here. Theodore Parker sat in his home in Boston where he harbored fugitive slaves and was prepared to defend them with the loaded gun he kept in his desk drawer. Advocates for women's suffrage picketed and paraded, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton organized and convened. In the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King invited us all to show up with our bodies and our voices to march the streets of the Deep South. And when gay marriage became a real possibility in some states, progressives of all religious stripes rallied around lawsuits that made a difference. Lawsuits that are pending still. Work that we have been a part of. And change happened in that case not when we picketed for it, but because courts upheld it. But how do we approach the need for change in society now? What should be our tool? Shall we picket, march, convene, write, lecture, sue? Perhaps we should do all of those things in their right times and in appropriate measure. Maybe they all matter, and some of them have the added benefit of making us feel better about the world, too. But there is an aspect present to these great successful movements for change that we can pluck up out of the history of liberal religion, an aspect of every one of these great movements that we so desperately need to apply to our efforts for change now. An underpinning of everything that ever worked that is well represented in the reading we had today from Greg Mortensen in Three Cups of Tea. Namely, I think change comes when we build actual relationships with one another in this world. Change comes when we get to know not just the people we imagine ourselves to be helping, but also the people we think are on the other side of our greatest divides. Change comes when we actually relate deeply to our community and see ourselves not just as its saviors, but as those who are in need of a bit of saving too. I am weary of well-intentioned upper-middle-class liberals speaking ad nauseum of the needs of the poor without actually speaking to, relating to, or living among the poor. I am weary of efforts to change the world by binding up the broken, assuming all the while that we ourselves are so marvelously whole. This creates distance more than change. It lets us imagine that we are not the ones in need. When in fact, the truth is irrevocably that we are so desperately in need that we reach out to those poor ones, those hungry ones, those broken ones in the quiet prayer that even as we offer up those services, they might heal us too, and we might in turn be fed. When we offer food, we are fed tenfold. When we offer our words, we are given clarity and purpose. When we offer our picket signs and our protest marches, we're given zeal and energy in return. When Greg Mortensen stumbled into that tiny Pakistani village of Corfay, it was not as the Savior come to fix them all. He was, in fact, a ragged shell of a man. Grieving the death of his sister, he tried to climb a mountain and plant a flag of meaning and power at its summit. He didn't make it, and he got lost, and he was hungry, and he found his way to these people who put him back together again. He was not their Savior. They were his. He was not the white knight. He was the weary traveler, for whom there was on this occasion space enough at the inn. And when he took the chance to make a difference, to give back, it was not in an effort to bestow his gifts upon the ragged poor, but to offer up some glimmer of the gift that those poor had given him. He was not their Savior. He was their friend. And he was willing to be in deep and meaningful relationship with them long enough for the care and change and growth to be a mutual experience in which all were so deeply engaged that it actually changed the world. Through his efforts, Mortensen has overseen the building of 64 schools in total, which have helped 26,000 children, including 16,000 young women who had no other access to education. A recent figure stated that there were 55 such schools in Pakistan, 8 in Afghanistan, and another dozen under construction. His philosophy, from the start of all his programs, has been that the only real way to counteract terrorism is by building relationships, and through those relationships, offering education that leads to freedom. During his work founding schools in those war-torn areas, he has been kidnapped by Pakistani tribesmen, involved in a firefight with opium smugglers in Afghanistan. He has been on the receiving end of 2 fatwas from radical Muslim clerics who opposed his advocacy for the education of girls, death threats from American citizens who opposed his work for the education of young Muslims, and multiple CIA investigations. Through all of that, it is not an abstraction of the great masses of needy that keeps him going. It is not even a need to prove his worth. It is the fact that he knows the people in need of help. In fact, he is one of them. He has lived among them. He is them. He has been tended by the people, and he knows deep down inside that the line between them and us isn't indelibly printed on the fabric of the world. It isn't there at all. Change. Change in the way Christians relate to Muslims. Change in the way radical Muslims relate to the world. Change in the way people of faith speak of one another. Change in the seemingly unquenchable battle between Israel and Palestine. Change for the hungry people in Manassas who come to us for food. Change. We can do 1,000 things to bring about change. Guided by the experience and wisdom of our history, we can work, speak, protest, be imprisoned, and set others free. We can pack a gun or a feather or a grain of salt as our weapons. We can be angry or we can be gentle. We can give food and we can receive care. All of it has more power if we are deeply in relationship with this world we hope to change and deeply in relationship with those whom we hope to change it with. Not those whom we hope to change it for. Not those ones who are so pitiful and in need, but those people with whom we share the burden and the obligation of change. All of us hungry, and all of us in it together. Change doesn't start with charity. It starts with community, with being among the people. Every one of us in need of someone somewhere who would bind up our wounds so that we might in turn tend well to others.